today. As Labour unveils its manifesto, what's its vision for a more nationalised economy? And Max Rushton on Jose Mourinho's return to the Premier League. Labour released their election manifesto today, promising the biggest house-building programme for decades, and alongside it, the most radical shake-up of the economy in a generation.
And I'll let you into a little secret. It's going to knock your socks off. You're going to love it.
At the heart are plans to take key industries back into public ownership. Rail, mail, energy, water and broadband.
Fast and free broadband for all will fire up our economy.
After decades of privatisation and cross-party support for free markets, Labour says customers are fed up of rising prices and stagnating services.
Your consumers have been failed by rip-off energy bills and very poor rail and bus services in many parts of the country.
But would government-run industries really work any better? From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, what would Labour's nationalisation programme mean for Britain? Today I've got two big brains from The Guardian's business desk with me, financial editor Niels Prattley and economics editor Larry Elliott. Larry, let me just start with you. Clearly what we're seeing is Jeremy Corbyn's vision for the economy, but also that of his old friend and closest political ally, Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell. I mean, you know him well. If we think of Labour's political giants of the past century, where does he get his inspiration from?
He'd obviously like to be seen as the new Clement Attlee. 1930s, huge shock to the global economy. The economy malfunctioned and people were looking around for new ideas. Labour was out of power for a long time in the 1930s, came into power in 1945 with a radical programme of change.
The Labour Party's great victory shows that the country is ready for a new policy to face new world conditions.
And took over all the big industries, coal, rail, water, electricity, all of them taken into state ownership. I think that what McDonald sees is a transformation of the UK economy as profound as that.
I mean, that was one fifth of the British economy. And it wasn't particularly controversial at the time or for decades after.
Labour won such a big majority for it. And the economy did start to perform reasonably well in the late 40s, early 1950s, that it became a bipartisan policy.
And to a large extent, that consensus around nationalisation lasted until Thatcher's election in 1979. The Conservatives today, when they try and oppose this as a policy, they kind of usher up an image of the 1970s.
During today's extended power cuts, it was almost impossible for many families who depend upon electricity to cook or to heat and light their homes. Summer camping stoves and old paraffin lamps had been brought out of the attic and dusted down. It was meals by candlelight, but only for those who bought them before supplies ran out. It's now almost impossible to buy a candle, a stove or a heater. How are some people getting on?
I'm getting on splendidly, thank you. First thing in the morning, I fill my hot water bottle and put it into my couch.
At home, a factory in Glamorgan is trying to meet the demand for paraffin heaters and lamps. But, as at most factories, the 600 workers are being hamstrung by the very power cuts they're trying to alleviate. They're limited to a three-day week under the emergency restrictions.
They paint the idea of power cuts and strikes of the three-day week and the winter of discontent. Is that fair? What was it like at the time with massive nationalisation?
Well, I think that over time, the public's view of nationalisation changed a bit because the way in which the nationalised industries operated was not perfect. It was very top-down. It's quite bureaucratic. People had no great love for British Rail or British Telecom or British Airways when it was in public ownership. It was not great. I mean, you know, a lot of the nationalised industries didn't work that well, partly because they were starved of investment every time there was an economic crisis. But I think the really big change came in the 1970s. A big ideological change happened with the rise of the free market right, because they did have a critique not just of the role of the state, the size of the state, what the state should be doing and what the state shouldn't be doing. And that was all wrapped up in its critique of overmighty trade unions, too generous welfare, acceptance of too high levels of inflation, and the idea that you needed to inject some private sector dynamism back into the economy became part of the Thatcherite prescription.
Niels, it's fair to say that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell back then weren't massive fans of Margaret Thatcher. Why is that?
Well, there's a fundamental ideological difference. I mean, Thatcher spoke about privatisation as rolling back socialism.
You have talked about eliminating socialism completely as a second force in British politics. Is that a practical proposition, and is it a right one to aim at?
I've never thought that socialism, as it goes further and further left, and it is really in tune with the British character. And I've always longed for the time when we had two main parties, government and opposition, which both believed fundamentally in the same things: freedom under the law and backed up by a free enterprise society. The fact is that once the Conservative Party took over the welfare state and ran it rather better than our opponents, there really was only one place for Labour to go, and that was further and further left. That's why they want to nationalise everything, that's why they want to control everything, that's why they'd like more people in council houses. They want to control people's lives. We don't believe in running it that way.
She thought that the managers of companies needed to believe that those companies could go bust. She thought that was the way to bring greater efficiency. I mean, there were something like 600,000 jobs passed from the public sector to the private sector during the Thatcher years via privatisation.
And the list of companies is huge, isn't it?
Yeah, this is not a comprehensive list, but here's a few: Cable and Wireless, Associated British Ports, Jaguar, BT, British Gas, British Airways, Rolls-Royce, British Airports Authority, all the water companies and the electricity companies. And then after Thatcher, under Major, there was British Rail.
And one of the ways that it was sold to people was, here are your shares.
Yeah, the marketing around this and the hype was generated partly through TV ads. It was sort of primetime TV ads. British Gas, the campaign, still remembered to this day, was Tell Sid, a postman on his bike saying, "Tell Sid."
Oi!
Oh, glad you're here. This'll interest you. British Gas shares, they come out in November. If you see Sid, tell him.
Who's Sid?
Sid was the mythical great British investor.
More information and to reserve a prospectus, phone 0272 272 272 anytime.
And they came forward in their droves because the public pretty quickly cottoned on that these things were being sold off cheaply. And almost all the shares went up immediately. So it was free money for a lot of people.
The punters queued in their hundreds to beat the clock on the final day of the offer of shares in the 12 regional electricity companies. The shares were priced at £2.40. The offer was comfortably oversubscribed. The Labour Party accused the Energy Secretary of selling public assets at an enormous discount.
And I remember the TV reports of the day, you would see the piles and piles of applications being sorted, all with sort of cheques attached to them.
It was raising huge amounts of cash for the government, but what did it mean for customers? Were the trains better?
No, not noticeably. I mean, the complaints about privatisation set in quite quickly. And some of the industries, you've got to say, were privatised in the wrong form. I mean, the debate about the structure of the rail industry continues to this day. And, you know, by 1997, when New Labour came in, it was pretty much accepted that the companies had been sold too cheaply and there was excess profiteering. New Labour put in a £5 billion windfall tax on the privatised utilities, and there was barely a squeak of protest. That was accepted as a fair play.
There may have been a windfall tax, but Larry, Tony Blair's biggest early move as leader, arguably, was to abolish Clause 4 from Labour's constitution. That had basically committed the party to public ownership.
Some of you I hear support me simply because you think I can win. But it's not enough. I want more. We are not going to win despite our beliefs. We will only win because of our beliefs. It requires a modern constitution that says what we are in terms the public cannot misunderstand and the Tories cannot misrepresent.
And it was a pivotal moment, wasn't it? Because it marked a new direction for Labour, away from those nationalisations of the past, away from socialism.
And that's essentially what Blair did. He said, you know, globalization's a fact of life. Capitalism is a fact of life. What you can do is knock off some of the rough edges through regulation and through supervision and through tax. But essentially, we buy into the idea that industries are better off in the private sector than in the public sector. There was a rump of people on the left who opposed this tooth and nail.
John, with me, two more representatives of New Labour, and you can see the sartorial diversity of New Labour. With me in his Dennis the Menace tie, Dennis McShane, and the woolly jumper and desert boots, Jeremy Corbyn. Gentlemen, let's talk about the substance of the speech. What did you find of note?
Well, they want to win the election, and that's the desperation. But I do think the serious points in the speech have to be the question of the party's constitution.
But the sense was that the people on the left, you know, John McDonnell, Jeremy Corbyn, Diane Abbott, were essentially, you know, yesterday's men and women. I mean, they were, you know, like Canute telling the tide not to come in. And essentially, that was the view, that the future was an acceptance of privatisation, and therefore they had to lump it.
Niels, in 97, interestingly, John McDonnell became an MP, but wasn't fast-tracked into Blair's government, let's be honest. He sat on the back benches and he continued to argue for the left, and clearly would have been one of the people who was very upset about the Clause 4 decision. But you mentioned the windfall tax on companies at the time. Were there any other things that Labour did to move the dial back from where we had been under Thatcher?
It wasn't particularly an interest of New Labour. Then the financial crisis came along in 08, 09, and that obviously dominated political debate for a long time. I think the weather on this really only started to change with Ed Miliband as leader of the Labour Party. He gave a big speech in 2013 at Labour Party conference in which he proposed,
"The next Labour government will freeze gas and electricity prices until the start of 2017.
And that did ignite a big debate, and it was proved very popular. It polled very well. In the end, the Tories had to introduce a price cap of their own in a slightly different form.
It's a pretty similar form, I seem to remember.
After
they called him Red Ed and smeared him in the newspapers. I mean, it's interesting that you go back to Ed Miliband, because I guess nowadays it's hard to remember that in 2010, when he became leader, Larry, it was seen as a left-wing choice. He beat his Blairite brother, in fact, to the job. The party wasn't quite ready for John McDonnell at the time. In fact, he did run in that leadership election and got nowhere. But clearly there was a shift coming. Do you think that the financial crash underpinned that change of direction?
Yeah, I think it did. I think with a slow burn, it's been as influential in terms of the Labour Party as the Great Depression of the 1930s was on Labour policy. I mean, I think it took a while. I mean, you know, Niels rightly talked about how Labour was not, under Blair and Brown, was not ideologically in tune with the idea of renationalisation. I mean, when the financial crisis broke,
they began queuing at this Northern Rock branch well before 8 o'clock this morning. And despite yesterday's reassurances, customers still don't really seem to be confident that their money is safe.
The size of Northern Rock means it's unthinkable that it would go bust. But what if the unthinkable happened?
Labour resisted up to the utmost to avoid taking Northern Rock under public ownership, eventually did so very reluctantly. But the Labour Party line at that time was, we'll give these banks some emergency help, but we want them back in the private sector as soon as possible. So that's really where they were positioned. But essentially, the financial crisis did move the dial in a very, very big way in terms of the public, because you know, the public responded to the crisis initially by buying into the idea of austerity. After 4 or 5 years, they'd had enough. They'd had enough of the idea that the people who'd caused the crisis had got away scot-free. They'd had enough of the idea that they'd had to tighten their belts, and they were looking around for a new and better way to run the economy. So they were ripe for the idea that McDonnell and Corbyn came up with in 2015, which was, let's have a good dose of old-fashioned socialism, because the neoliberal model has broken down in a fundamental way.
Today, we celebrate an amazing triumph and an amazing victory. United together, wanting to achieve something better and something decent, a society based on socialist values. Together, we are very, very strong. Thank you very much.
I think it surprised Corbyn and McDonnell themselves. In 2015, when Jeremy Corbyn ran for the leadership, he got there with some nominations from MPs who were on the right of the party, who just wanted to widen the debate. I mean, the shock on the faces of some of those MPs when he was elected leader with such a thumping majority. And as Larry said, they really, really turned the dial. I mean, they had an election in 2017 when many would say they had a very radical policy. And to everyone's surprise, they stripped Theresa May of her majority, even though they didn't win. We're now ready for another manifesto for 2019. And we know that this kind of socialist vision is at the heart of it. In terms of nationalisation, what does this Labour Party want to do?
Well, let's go through.
You know, building an economy for the many also means bringing ownership and control of the utilities and key services into the hands of the people who use them and work in them.
So the first one, and the one you would assume would be the first to be nationalised, would be the 10 regional water companies in England and Wales. McDonnell has spoken at length about those.
Our plans for a new publicly owned water system that puts this essential service where? Back in the hands of local councils, workers and customers themselves.
Then they've outlined their plans for the energy sector.
Have been failed by rip-off energy bills.
So a large chunk of what we call National Grid PLC would be nationalised. Companies that own the electricity pylons and the wires, the companies that own the gas pipes.
Energy, Royal Mail.
Royal Mail.
Taking them back.
There would also be trains.
Just want to say to Richard Branson, if I have any doubts about renationalising the rail, I tell you, to yesterday made it clear. It's coming back.
And then now we have got BT Openreach, as we learnt last week.
So here it is. A Labour government will make broadband free for everybody.
BT Openreach is the provider of broadband across Britain. It's 33,000 employees. It's a £5 billion turnover company. And the unusual feature, really unusual feature of this one, is that, you know, Labour proposes that broadband will become free for all consumers and all businesses. I've got to say, this proposal looks the least worked out of all the others. It's come late in the day, quite close to an election, and some pretty obvious questions that people are asking about this policy. McDonnell gave pretty vague answers. For example, what do you do with the competitors to British Broadband? You know, clearly Virgin Media and the broadband bits of TalkTalk and Sky and Vodafone are going to struggle to compete with a state-owned competitor that's giving away the product for free.
Didn't they get their sums wrong as well?
A figure that McDonnell was using was to describe the running costs of this network, of the broadband network, was £230 million a year. And you struggle to see where that figure comes from, because if you look in BT's accounts, what it's showing as under operating costs is about £2.6 billion, which sounds more like it for a company with 33,000 employees.
That's quite a big difference.
Huge difference.
I mean, talking about people getting their figures wrong, not surprisingly, lots of business doesn't like Labour's plans to nationalise things. And in fact, the Confederation of British Industry said that the nationalisation plans would cost £196 billion. But in an email exchange between Labour and the CBI seen by The Guardian, it turned out they got that figure totally wrong.
The CBI, with that £196 billion figure, was including the cost of nationalising the rolling stock on the train. So that's the trains and the carriages. It is not Labour's policy to actually nationalise the carriages and the trains that are on the network at the moment.
And that's interesting, because the truth is we don't know how much it would cost. And just to give you an example of how much variation there is in estimates, a number from Greenwich University suggests £49.7 billion, which a lot of people are saying is extremely low. Can we just go through some of the individual areas that we're talking about? Because presumably there's not a kind of one size fits all answer to this. I mean, we'll come back to broadband that you've touched on, Niels, but, you know, Corbyn famously argued for nationalisation of the railways. A lot of the companies might have wanted to attack him, but it was incredibly popular because a lot of people find private train companies incredibly annoying. They seem to run late, they can be packed, the prices keep going up. I mean, is there an argument that we'd be better off with a shift back to nationalisation here?
I think a lot of people have come round to that view. I think rail nationalisation is popular even amongst Tory voters. So unhappy are they with the state of the railways. I mean, I think to an extent we do look at it a bit through rose-tinted spectacles. I don't think if you'd gone back 40 years and asked people, what do you think of British Rail, you probably would have got a fairly dusty answer. So, you know.
What was it like? Come on, you remember it. You were telling us.
You make me sound so old. Which I am, obviously.
You were working at the time.
I mean, I don't remember. I just remember coming into work on a train. It was, you know, not that much different. The trains were slightly less crowded. I mean, one of the problems that people have got today, I think, is not just that the trains are late, is that, you know, there doesn't seem to be very much connectivity between the various rail operating companies, and they're so flipping crowded and expensive, and, you know, so you can see why people are unhappy. But the question for the Labour Party is, you know, how are you going to make the trains less crowded? How are you going to make more synergy between the various parts of the network? How are you going to do it at a price that the consumers are prepared to pay?
Well, I think the case for nationalisation in rail is probably strongest of all the industries we've spoken about. Some of the franchise companies like Stagecoach, like National Express, have sort of given up on pitching for franchises because they can't see the money to be made from it. They don't like the risks that they're asked to take on pensions in the case of Stagecoach. And some of the companies that are running trains in our railways are state-owned operators. They're just not UK state companies. So there's Deutsche Bahn from Germany runs trains in our railways. Abellio from the Netherlands runs trains in our railways. So it seems a little odd to resist state operators if you're quite happy to have state operators from other countries running. And we've also got examples of publicly owned companies on the East Coast now twice they've had to take back the franchise into public ownership and run railways. The world has not fallen apart. People still go up and down the East Coast.
I mean, you're both selling mass nationalisation to me here. I mean, what are the risks of nationalisation?
Well, for example, with the water companies, we can all see that the case for nationalisation is, quite apart from the sort of fat cat salaries, is that a lot of money has been ripped out of the industry in the form of dividends for shareholders. Some of it's been gone via Cayman Island structures, and that there seems to be a lack of accountability. But the case against it is that actually alongside all these dividends, the water industry has invested something like 130, 140 billion since privatisation in repairing Victorian era pipes and getting reservoirs up to scratch, and that maybe more infrastructure is needed as climate change happens. And is that really going to be delivered under public ownership if you've got a Treasury dishing out funds and having to choose between, you know, a new hospital or does it build a new reservoir in East Anglia?
The second possible drawback is what sort of signals does it send to investors, both domestic and international, particularly the surprise with BT Openreach? Does that send out the message to international investors, come over here and invest? And does it send out the message to domestic investors, it's a good idea for you to build up your company on the, you know, if it's at risk of being appropriated by the government?
What is John McDonald's kind of driving motivation to go that far?
Essentially, he believes that state ownership works. We have a low productivity, low wage, low growth economy, you know, low investment economy. There hasn't been any of the real benefits of privatisation that its supporters said there would be in the 1980s. So let's try something different.
Niels, it seems to me that the debate around this is often quite knee-jerk. And in fact, there are clearly legitimate arguments on a case-by-case basis. Each industry is quite different. I think a lot of people accept that there are big problems in a number of these industries. For those who say nationalisation isn't the answer, is there an alternative?
Yeah, and I think on the nationalisation debate, the one lasting piece of criticism that has absolutely stuck is that the regulation around privatised utilities has been too weak for too long. I mean, the excesses of the 90s that then continued into the noughties and were highlighted by Ed Miliband in 2013, are really born of failure of regulation. The Tories, when they privatised, did not put in tough enough regulation around some of these industries, particularly water and particularly energy. I think those factors are now being seen. That's why McDonnell was able to capture the public mood and why there has been such a sort of powerful feeling that something ought to be reformed. You know, the question is, do you need to nationalise or do you need to reform the regulation?
And Larry, for all the debate around this, for all the pushback from parts of the media, from industry, for all the supposed unpopularity of Jeremy Corbyn himself, Corbynomics, if you like to call it that, does seem quite popular.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, Labour has won the economic debate. 10 years ago, Labour did not win the economic debate. When George Osborne imposed austerity, that was entirely the wrong policy. It was really, really dumb economics. And Labour reeled badly in the face of that and suffered badly as a result. Corbyn has really, really moved the debate on so that now both parties are effectively anti-austerity parties. Both parties are now saying that we should borrow more money to invest in capital projects. And both parties are really falling over themselves to offer stuff to voters for free. One example of the new mood is going to be announced in Labour's manifesto today, and that's the pledge to build 100,000 new council homes every year in the next parliament at a cost of £75 billion. Now, this is kind of interesting because the big privatisation programme of the 1980s also coincided with the right to buy and the selling off of council houses. So we've come full circle, not just with nationalisation and privatisation, but also with council houses. And that's a tribute, I think, to the way in which Labour has moved the debate on in the last few years.
That was Larry Elliott and Niels Prattley. They are world experts on all of this. Do read their excellent reporting at theguardian.com. Coming up, the special one returns. Now, the sacking of Tottenham Hotspur's manager, Maurizio Pochettino, has opened the door for the return to the Premier League of Jose Mourinho, one of football's most controversial and successful managers. Max Rushton is the presenter of The Guardian's Football Weekly podcast.
Most Tottenham fans are still in a sort of processing stage of this. Football does move very quickly, but at the same time, I don't think anybody really thought that Pochettino would get sacked. My dad put me in a Tottenham shirt when I was 5 years old. After every Tottenham game, he rings me at 2 minutes after the game's finished to tell me how good Jimmy Greaves was. Jimmy Greaves played in the 60s. He got to see Tottenham win things, actually. In my lifetime, I've seen FA Cups and League Cups and not a lot else. And so for Tottenham to get to the Champions League final last season, the European Cup final, for the first time in their history, was an amazing moment. What Pochettino gave Tottenham was joy and hope, and they got to see players blossom like Harry Kane and Dele Alli and Heung-min Son. But he'd never won a trophy, and there will be lots of pundits in lots of places regarding his tenure at Tottenham as a failure because he didn't win anything. I suppose it depends how you judge football, right? The consensus that going from Pochettino to Mourinho is a backward step is very much because Jose was hugely successful in the early 2000s. He did win the Premier League in 2015, but he has a history of it all falling apart and it ending acrimoniously and him getting angry and publicly criticising his players. We don't know what happens behind the scenes, but there was something about Pochettino that he seemed like a very nice bloke.
I am always so calm and try to enjoy the game and be fresh to try to help the team.
And it's hard to argue the case that Jose Mourinho is a really nice bloke.
I'm European champion, so I'm not one of the bottle. I think I'm a special one.
Whether that matters in elite sport, I don't know. I feel it does. I want to like the people who are playing for my football team and managing my football team. Do I think it's a choice of having a nice manager or winning trophies? No, I don't. There is definitely that argument. I mean, if you look at, you know, Gareth Southgate, the England manager, was told by loads of people he was too nice. He tried to get the Sheffield United job in 2013. And the director's kids went to the same school as him. And they were worried that he used to say hello to all the parents and kids outside the school grounds. Southgate was like, what do you want me to do? Chuck my kids out the back. Football fans are fickle, right? And I'm fickle. And if Jose gets a trophy, I will A, eat some humble pie, and I'll B, think it was the right decision. And you need to be ruthless, but I still think you can be nice and ruthless at the same time. Amazon Prime have been following Tottenham Hotspur this season. And as soon as everyone found this out, every other set of fans just found it hilarious because Tottenham's season hasn't started so well. The thing about these football documentaries is they're only good if the team are having a terrible time, right? So Man City did one, but who cares? Because Man City were winning at the start and they won at the end and they kept winning, and you need to see disaster. It's obviously ridiculous to suggest it, but you sort of wonder if Amazon have paid so much that they've got to script this. They're saying, look, it's not going that well, but hey, why don't we just sack Pochettino and get Mourinho in? And it goes from made in Chelsea to made in Tottenham. The happiest people out of all of this are Amazon Prime, I presume.
My thanks to Larry Elliott, Niels Prattley and Max Rushton. And thanks again to you for all your comments, tweets, reviews. Do encourage your friends to give Today in Focus a go. Today's episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.